Yes, they are. Good planets are hard to find. Hello, Case Good listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly Case Good radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. We live in a highly visual culture. Some might say it's too visual. Visual media are not only informative, they are also affective. That is to say, they affect emotions. Sometimes not to society's benefit, as we've been seeing over the last few years. My guest today is well-versed and deeply immersed in producing both informative and affective media, Eric Tierman. During his 40-year career, Tierman has filmed, produced, and directed hundreds of media projects in over 40 countries. These include Art and the Prison Crisis, The Last Epidemic, Medical Consequences of Nuclear Weapons and Nuclear War, In the Nuclear Shadow, What Can Children Tell Us?, nominated for an Academy Award in 1984, and Women for America, which received the Academy Award for Best Short Documentary Film in 1986. More recently, he's been involved in creating educational media for children, including a radio show called Kids on Climate and Connected Universe, a game-like educational platform where the player is offered an island paradise which is suffering from climate change. Eric Tierman, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Thank you, Ronnie. And thanks for having me on your show, and thanks to all your listeners who care about this kind of thing, which is important. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, before we get into the nuts and bolts, you know, I saw on your website that you followed a team, citizen diplomacy team to Russia in the late 1980s, and you got to meet Mikhail Gorbachev, and he just died this past week. I was wondering if you have any reflections on Gorbachev. Did you meet him and talk to him?
We met him and talked to him, and he spoke Russian the whole time. I understand that he spends a lot of time in New York, so I think he knew English quite well, but he didn't want to use it. But in any event, we had a private audience. There were about 30 of us in the room, and he spoke for about an hour to us about his relationship with Ronald Reagan and the whole area of the 80s when Reagan and he became friends. We got back, we were asked to post the material online, and we had a Russian translate it, but we found out that the translation was so off that we retranslated it. And if you're ever interested in seeing that, it's quite interesting to hear his reflections on what he felt like he accomplished in his life.
Maybe you can tell me later where I can find it, and I'll post it on the website. So why don't we start at the beginning? How do you describe what you do, and how did you get into this field of work?
It's a great existential question. How do I describe what I do? I was thinking a lot about that, because I know you want me to say I make films and that's what I do, but it started much earlier than that for me. And I think I feel like what I do is I try to see the potential in things. I see the potential in objects. I see the potential in people, and I try to empower people to be something other than what they think they can be. In other words, I think most people have enormous potential. I think objects have enormous potential, and so I repurpose a lot of things in life. So what I do, I started off doing magic shows when I was 12. That's kind of when I started my professional career, doing magic shows for $5. I loved magic. I loved playing that game with people and fooling people. And then when I got into college, somebody asked me for a photograph that I'd taken of a group of magical singers up at UC Santa Cruz. I was in the first class, the first year UC Santa Cruz started, and the photographer hadn't shown up at this occasion. So I gave her this photograph when it was developed, and she said, "Can you shoot more photos?" And I said, "Sure." But my camera was kind of like the equivalent of an Instamatic back then. So she borrowed a camera, and I started shooting photos. She gave me a roll of film and a list. I went out and shot it. She gave me another roll of film and a list. I went out and shot it. I did this for about 4 or 5 months, and a book came out, which was really thrilling. Then they gave me the contract to do the next year. I got for 300 pictures printed, and I had to learn how to print that summer. I got $300, dollar a print. So another book came out. And as a result of that, the poet laureate at UC Santa Cruz, he just happened to write a lot of poetry, came up to me and said, I've got this poem that's very visual, and I'd love to make a film about it. And I said, well, I don't have a film camera. I've never made a film. He said, well, we can borrow Paul Lee's camera. And Paul Lee, who was an ethics professor back then, was my ethics professor. He had this regular eight movie camera. And Paul Lee's still alive up there, still kicking, still swinging. I just saw him yesterday. And we shot this movie. And that's when I got bit. I got the cinema, you know, the film bite. And that was third year up here at UC Santa Cruz. So I did not graduate from UC Santa Cruz. I transferred out. There was nothing in film or photography to keep me there. I had to learn more about film. So I went to UCLA Film School, went through their graduate program, and then, you know, that's how I got into it. This was pre-Instamatic. It was like, I think Instamatic came out about 20 years after 1965. It was...
So you got an MFA in motion pictures at UCLA. What was that like?
UCLA was great. We watched movies all day, every day. We made movies. I made 5 movies while I was at UCLA, and several of them got distributed by luck or some such thing. The first movie I made there went out with Woodstock, the big movie that starred all those great musicians back then, and they wanted... The distribution company wanted a short film to open it, kind of like a teaser. And I had made this film about a young woman turning into a butterfly, and they liked it. And so they said, well, they could pay me $300 for the all rights to that movie. And I said, sure. And then that went around. And then another one was, a few films got distributed. And then I left UCLA. It was a filmmaking school. And you learn, when you go to filmmaking school, you learn filmmaking if you make a lot of films. I mean, if you really work with films, it's like anything. You do it a lot, you get better at it.
Although I imagine not everybody who graduates from the film school ends up doing it, you know, doing it successfully.
There were only 5% of the people who graduated from film school at UCLA who ever had anything to do with film afterward.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say that those 5% were the best 5% of the bunch.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's a whole nother thing to get into the business. I thought people were going to beat my door down when I got out of UCLA because I had made these films, and I did have a pretty good shot at a feature film that I'd written. Peter Fonda had been in an Easy Rider, and 20th Century had a 7 picture contract with him. So I wrote this movie called Steel Heel back in 72, and I got a call from this guy from 20th. He says, we want you to and I had an agent at the time. We want Peter Fonda to be in this movie. And I said, well, you know, I've promised it to another friend of mine who's an actor, and I have to honor that. And they said, are you sure you want to do that? And I said, you know, they said, you can direct it. And I said, I'd love to direct it, but I already promised it to this other dude, and I want to honor that. And so that was my shot. It was fine. I have no regrets. I ended up making that movie 20 years later in Santa Cruz, Action Adventure Steel Heel. A lot of people were involved in that. Probably some people who are listening remember it somewhat. It was a really low-budget movie. We raised $100,000. We used the butcher from Shopper's Corner to be the star in the movie. And... We rolled semis. We shut down Highway 17. We used the Davenport cement plant and both the Watsonville and the Salinas police station. We got every location for free, and I just want to shout out to all the people who helped with that movie. We ended up, you know, it went out, and I got a distributor, and I kept calling him. I said, "How's it doing?" He said, "Great. We haven't reached profit yet. We're still selling it in the world markets," because they would go out and they'd sell 8,000 to Argentina and 20,000 to China and 5,000 to Podunk, you know, wherever. And then they turned into an answering machine. Mm. And I couldn't get in touch with them. And I understood they just went out of business. So they'd already sold rights to a lot of it around the world. And so I got another distributor. And the same thing happened. So I can say I safely got a really fantastic T-shirt out of that movie. It was designed by Nick Koenig, who Manu Koenig is his son. Mm-hmm. Nick Koenig is an amazing graphic designer, graphic artist here in town. And all I can say is the T-shirt was maybe the best thing I got out of the movie, besides a fantastic experience making the movie.
So that's the slogan. I made a movie and all I got was this lousy T-shirt, right?
No, this is a fantastic T-shirt. Yeah.
Well, I also read that you worked for Roger Corman.
I did. When I was going to UCLA, I was friends with Jonathan Demme, who made movies like Silence of the Lambs and Philadelphia and Stop Making Sense and, oh, Swinging to Cambodia. He made a whole slew of movies, probably 20 or 30, Married to the Mob. Mm. Anyway, he was a friend of mine. He was making films for Roger Corman. He was writing films, and he got a shot at directing his first feature called Caged Heat, about women in prison. And he asked me if I wanted to be the art director for it, because I guess he needed somebody who would work for $300 a week. I don't know. I mean, that's what I would.
That number keeps coming up. Huh?
The number keeps coming up. I 300, sure. That's my price. Still is my price. Anyway, I did a great job for Jonathan on that movie. I ransacked L.A. for free props, and I brought him. We outfitted a women's prison, so many other things for $2,000. That was my budget for the entire feature film for the art department and all of the building. And several people here, Richard Furneaux, who an architect who designed one of the student union up at UC Santa Cruz, a really well-known architect. He helped me on that, and Wayne Cartwright and a few other people. Anyway, yeah, that was fun too. That was Roger Corman. And Jonathan Demme, yeah, that was, you know, a short thing. And then I got a lot of calls after that to be art director, because I had created so much for these guys, and I filled their walls with stuff. I mean, just stuff that I got for free. And so I got all these calls from all these other producers who wanted me to do the same thing for them. But I honestly wanted to make movies. I wanted to write movies. I wanted to make stories and direct my own movies. And so I stopped doing that. I said, no, thanks. I want to do something else. And as a result, I did this little stint with Steel Heel. And when that kind of went south, Sid and Marty Croft optioned it for a couple of years. They used to make the Donnie and Marie Osmond show. It was just not where I wanted to go. You know, it's like, no, this is not for me. So I applied for a grant at the American Film Institute. And I got this grant, and I said, okay, let's get out of L.A. I'm going back to where I love. I'm going back to Santa Cruz. And so with that $10,000, I bought some video gear. And nobody, it was the first color video camera that Sony put out that was portable, that you didn't have to plug in. It had a big battery, and you could walk around with it with a dolly. Nice. And a portable deck, 3/4 inch. And I started making movies. I came up here, and Eloise Smith, who was the wife of Paige Smith, who was the first provost of Cowell College, called me up and she said, what's it going to cost to go around to the prisons and interview prisoners who are doing artwork or they're doing crafts? I want to make an art program in the prison system, and I'm going to I want to document what's happening now. And I said, it won't cost anything. Let's go. So we went around to five of the maximum security prisons and talked to a bunch of people. I actually have a interesting little thing from that movie. This is the opening clip of Art in a Prison Crisis. It was typical of the kind of interviews that I did. I talked to hundreds of mostly men. We did go to Frontera, which is a women's prison down in L.A., but this was, I can click on this if you want and play it.
Yeah, go ahead. Let's see if it works.
I was at a very low ebb, and I recognized it even outside. I went to a local mental health clinic, and I told them, I said, listen, I'm an addict. I'm on parole. I want to quit. Please help me. And the person that interviewed me said, well, I'm very sorry. I can appreciate your problem, but we don't have any groups right now that you'd fit into. So why don't you check back with us later? Well, I think it was less than a month I was in prison for first-degree murder.
So I should give you context. I think films are a lot about the sound, but what was happening, coincidentally, while this inmate was talking, he was drawing on a large piece of poster board and painting the word art because he was in the art program. So many of these, there's so much talent. Well, there's talent everywhere, but just like outside, there's talent in the penal institutions everywhere. And this talent is just wasting away because people just don't have the opportunities to exercise it. But even now today, the William James Association, which Eloise and Paige Smith started way back when, 20, 30, 40 years ago, it's still going strong. Lori Brooks still runs that organization, the William James Association. They still do, they sponsor teachers and tutorials in the maximum security prisons, especially in Northern California, and they're doing a terrific job. Anyway, I made four new movies for Eloise, mostly PBS-type films, and helped, I think it helped her program, helped gain some credibility for her program. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the films you did about nuclear war.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I remember when The Last Epidemic was released, because partly I had a copy of the book from the conference, and especially how powerful a speaker Helen Caldicott was. What prompted you to make that film?
Well, my dad was an activist. My dad, Ian Tierman, was an activist. He's since gone into he used to call it into the next vibration, but he was an activist, and he always had this idea that he could in some way save the world from itself on some level. So he was always involved in either the Vietnam War or counseling draftees of that war or anyway, he came to me one day and he said, you know, there's this conference. I'm trying to alert people to the dangers of nuclear war. And there's this conference in San Francisco. There are a bunch of physicians who are at this conference. They're going to be talking about it. And I'd love to get some excerpts from that conference. My mental brain, who's been resisting this since I was 10, you know, this activism, you know, I kind of said, who wants to know about nuclear war? Nobody. It's, you know, it's depressing. But I didn't say it. I said, okay, Dad, whatever you need. So I went up there and I shot this conference, and brought it back down to Santa Cruz in a box. And he said, what's next? And I said, well, you have to go through it and figure out what pieces you want to play to the Rotary Clubs around Santa Cruz, because that's what he that's what he wanted to do. So he went through it, and he pulled all these pieces out, and I assembled them kind of together in a rough form, and it was about 40 minutes, and then we cut it down to 30 minutes, 35 minutes. And he said, okay, I'm going. I said, no, you got to put some visuals on this. I mean, they're talking about nuclear war. And I remember seeing this film when I was teaching at the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, just after I got out of UCLA. I was teaching film production and film analysis. And I remember showing this movie called Hiroshima Nagasaki 1945. And it blew my mind when I saw it. I checked it out of the LA Public Library. They had these 16-millimeter films you could check out. And I remembered that film, and I checked it out. I broadcast it on my wall, and I videotaped it off the wall. That's how much I cared about what I was doing that. I mean, I was just making a movie for my dad to take around to Rotary clubs. Get it? I mean, I wasn't going to spend some money getting it properly transferred. And it was, so I put these images in where they belonged, had, you know, nuclear weapons blowing up, and, you know, I got things off the web, not off the web, actually. The web didn't exist. I just videotaped things off of 60 millimeter films that I rented. And I put this thing together. My father started showing it around. Everybody wanted copies of that thing. So I said, great, let's give it to the Resource Center for Nonviolence here in town. And they, I think there was four people working for 2 years sending that thing out to churches and schools and hospitals. And I mean, it just went everywhere. It was in six languages. It was shown in Congress. It was in Life magazine. It just went nuts. And I was just like watching this thing that had a life of its own, because I gave it away. I mean, I wasn't interested in making money on it. How can you make money off of social issues? It just never really appealed to me. So I would just give these things away. And I even made the VHS tapes. I started cranking these VHS tapes out, because VHS started to become a thing then.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just started cranking them out. And I got calls from the distributors in L.A. saying I was this bad apple in the barrel, because they were selling VHSs for the same price as the 16-millimeter film, which is $300-$400. And I said, why do that? Let's sell it for $10. Let's get it out the door. And anyway, it went nuts. It was fun. I can play you that excerpt from Helen Caldicott, which is the last little piece, if you want to hear it.
Yeah, no, I think that'd be great. So our listeners can hear her.
And I'll tell you something about what I think was the reason that film made such a splash. Here you go.
Governments were formed, in fact, in the past to protect the health and well-being of the societies. They worked in conjunction with doctors to provide clean water supplies. They worked together to provide adequate sewage, and in that way we eradicated much disease which was rampant throughout time. Governments must therefore work with us to eradicate the most serious problem the world has ever seen, nuclear war, which is medically contraindicated. This is the ultimate medical issue of our time. It is the ultimate medical issue since man has been on Earth for 3 million years. We are all adults, not children. We therefore inherited the Earth as our birthright, each one of us. Each one of us can be as powerful as the most powerful person on this Earth. We can blame nobody else but ourselves. We must take the world on our shoulders like Atlas, as physicians and as mature adults, and work towards this ultimate question. For no other issue really matters. It doesn't matter if we immunize babies so they won't develop pertussis and tetanus. It doesn't matter if we give them good, nutritious food. It doesn't matter if the marital relationships are good so the children grow in an emotionally secure environment. When you look at the concept that maybe over the next decade, these children that we are working to nurture, protect, and love will be dead. There are not communist children and capitalist children. They're all children. You just have to look at a baby, the beauty of a baby, to know what the symbol of life should be and what every single one of us in this world should be working to protect. The babies of this world who will pass the gene pool on to future generations. These weapons are biologically totally unacceptable. They must be eliminated. And this too is the ultimate religious issue. For what is our responsibility towards God? To continue this process of wonderful evolution that we know as physicians is, which has taken billions of years to happen. What is our responsibility to continue that?
You know, you hear her speak there, and she could be speaking about climate change.
And nuclear weapons still, right?
So, and there are just as many, if not more powerful, nuclear weapons. yeah, it's an issue that hasn't gone away. People just, in some ways, like climate change, they just kind of stick it under the rug over there. Maybe someone will figure it out sometime. But it's just as dangerous as it ever has been. But you know, at the end of what I was going to say as a filmmaker, she spoke for an hour. I edited it down to 4 minutes. That was 4 minutes out of that 30 minutes that my dad took around. Mm-hmm. But she was the last speaker. And then Linda Arnold came on with a song called Sweet Mother Earth. And at that moment, people had been subjected to a hypothetical attack on San Francisco. Had seen the devastation that had happened, would happen in San Francisco if a nuclear weapon went off there. We heard physicians who are one of the most credible group of individuals anywhere talk about all of the effects that would happen. You're pretty much lying on the ground at the end of this movie. But she does an empowering speech. Any one of us can be as powerful as the most powerful person on Earth. We must take the Earth on our shoulders like Atlas. Well, and then you say, well, what can I do? What can I do? You know what I did? The only brilliant thing that I really did with this movie is I put a placard right after Helen Caldicott's speech, because I knew everybody was going to go, what can we do? And there was a placard that said, you can help by showing this program to your local organizations. That's all it said. And that's why this movie went crazy. Everybody wanted a copy. They were people were grabbing copies and taking it to their churches, taking it to their synagogues, taking it to their hospitals, taking it everywhere they played this movie. Because somebody said, I've got a copy of it. I'm going to show it to the group. So that was probably one of the smarter things that I did with that film. That film was never went up for any awards. It just went out, and I was glad it was so widely seen.
It was a powerful film, and it came out at a time when lots of people were very worried about what the Reagan administration was up to.
Exactly.
You are listening to Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Eric Tierman, who has been a filmmaker for most of his life, if it's fair to use the term, and media production. How's that? That's today's term. And we're just talking about his film, The Last Epidemic. And then you made a film in the nuclear shadow. What can the children tell us? And I mean, I named the program, you know, in the climate shadow, what can the children tell us? So what was that? And that one was nominated for an Academy Award.
Yeah, right.
What was that about?
We got, it wasn't actually an original idea, because John Mack of Harvard University had done this, had done something similar in Russia. I think he went over and talked to kids about their impressions of a nuclear war. And I thought, well, why don't we do that with kids here? And so we got 50 kids, and their parents agreed to let us talk to them. They were 6 to 17, ages 6 to 17. And over a couple of day period, we had a list of questions. We gave the questions to the kids and the parents, and they would check the questions that they didn't want to answer, or they, you know, and then we just asked them the questions. And, you know, out of every child, we would spend maybe 15, 20 minutes talking to them. And then out of 50 or so kids, we came up with a 30-minute film. And I mean, filmmaking is about the editing process. It's about what you leave on the cutting room floor. I mean, that's gone. What you say, how you juxtapose the pieces together is really what filmmaking is all about. Because if it were about shooting, we'd all be Steven Spielbergs. Because we all have a camera in our pocket with our iPhone that's way better than anything I used in the first 30 years of filmmaking. Way better. And it records better sound. It records better visuals. So it really then boils down to shoot whatever you want, and then put it in front of yourself and figure out what other people, what kind of story you're trying to tell, and what other people will listen to. When my son went off to, I think it was Peru or someplace, he was doing something on coal-fired power plant down there, and he's a surfer, a big wave surfer, so he was going to do some surfing, and this coal-fired power plant was going to destroy this area, this surf spot. And he said, well, what do I do, Dad? And he was kind of on his way to the plane, and he was going to shoot this movie, and he never made a movie before. I said, well, just make it under 4 minutes, and I think you've got an audience for it. You know, a lot of times films, they're just too long.
Yeah.
They're just too long. Yeah. Just cut it. When I was, my first film that I did at UCLA, I showed it to this guy, his friend of mine, David Ward. He wrote The Sting and a couple other movies. I mean, there was a lot of people there that got famous, but I showed this movie to him. He said, cut it in half. And I said, cut it in half? How can I cut it in half? And he just said, take the beginning and end off every cut, and you'll probably have a good movie. So instead of a 10-minute movie, it was a 5-minute movie. And that 5-minute movie got distributed with Woodstock. So a lot of times films are just too long. I can just tell you that almost every film, there's something great in it that could be cut down to that greatness, and it would be a great movie.
Yeah, and our attention spans are much shorter today than they were 30 or 40 years ago, too.
I mean, 30 or 40 years ago, it was true, though.
Yeah. No, I've been actually wrestling with that, question of how long will people watch something before they zone out or turn it off. And it's not a lot. It's not a lot.
Yeah.
Hey, let's go on and talk about talk some more about your current work. So you just retired, right, from Impact Media, which
I'd been working with a great group of folks at Impact Creative, which coincidentally is right across the street from K-Squid. Did you know that?
No.
You know the Anatometal place right here across the street?
Uh-huh.
We're the building behind. So that's where the studio is. It's really funny. So a great group of folks. For years, everybody at Impact has been fantastic. And I think what happened to me is that I was kind of interested in the newer media, the VR, and where things were going there. I'd made enough corporate videos. I'd made millions of documentaries. I didn't really get into filmmaking to make documentaries. I did it because that's what people needed. They called me up and they said, can you do this? And I said, sure. And so I got into making documentaries and then lots of corporate videos for Google and Apple and Cisco. And I mean, they took me everywhere, all over the world. I went to 40 countries because of the companies that I worked for, and made millions of documentaries too, social documentaries. But I really wanted to tell stories. Documentaries are like, you videotape, you document something, and then you try to make something. In documentaries, you're trying to, you videotape something, and you try to stitch it together into some meaningful way. And what happens with stories is we're talking about the difference between documentary and dramatic filmmaking, and mm-hmm. I like telling stories. So I met a motion graphic artist named Ethan Summers and his wife Anne-Marie Summers, Anne-Marie Napoli, who had a company called Almost Human Media. And these guys were making some of the best motion graphics I'd ever seen. One day, Ethan said, what do you think of this? And I walked into I was in the studio. He'd rented one of the offices in this building Impact was in. And he showed me this environment that he created, which was photorealistic. He said, put these goggles on and walk around in this environment. And it kind of blew my mind. And I thought, this could be one of the most powerful educational tools. You could take people into these environments, teach them science, teach them anything. So we started building out this educational demo. We created photosynthesis as a model. We had labs in the forest. You could go in this lab. You could dive into the water. You could study the fish underneath the water. I mean, it was just like amazing. And we decided after talking to several big publishers, and they were interested, but, they're not quite ready for it yet, that kind of thing, that what really needed to be taught worldwide was climate change. People need to, they're looking for teachers to teach climate change everywhere because it's such a critical issue and there's so many careers that can come out of it. So I said, well, why don't we make an immersive game where, you know, where you, you're offered an island. And who hasn't ever wanted, well, there probably be some people out there who never wanted an island, but I always thought, wouldn't it be cool to have an island, your own island? And so you're offered an island, a virtual island that you land on and you look around and it's paradise. But as you start to walk through the island, you realize that this island is beset with climate change problems. The ocean has risen. The town is is partially underwater. Everybody's left. This island is abandoned. The farms are abandoned. The crops are ruined. Half the forest is burned. There are some species of animals that are still on the island, still trying to eke out a meager existence. And your job, should you choose to accept it, is to abate the problems on that island. And the way you do it is you travel off island to other places in the world, which have become known as places where climate change is being abated through very innovative methods. Mm-hmm. And we used this book, Regeneration, I'll think of it in a minute. We used several books. The Brookings Institute has a wonderful whole tutorial on teaching climate change to kids, and we just started amassing all of this information to create this island. So now we have a demo, and you know, I think we could give this thing away. It's the only way it's going to get out there. If we sell it, it'll get bottlenecked like most things do. So kind of like the last epidemic, I thought, why don't we just give it away? And there's got to be philanthropists out there who want to see this game, who will see the potential in it, who will support us finishing it. It's, you know, we want to build it out so that it has, right now it has a lot of the things that we'll propose, that we've proposed, and you can actually put goggles on and dive underneath the water and look at coral and go into a lab underwater. I'm going to hit the road. Mm-hmm. Next week, we have a demo. I'm going to hit the road next week, and I'm going to talk to people who want to support this this venture. Mm-hmm. And I think giving this thing away, what person who's teaching climate change in the world is not going to say, stream this game, look at this game, you are going to learn so much about climate change. We're giving away points. You know what Carbon Coin is?
Yeah.
You read that book. The Ministry of the
Ministry
Future.
Ministry for the Future, yeah. We're actually going to have him on K-Squid in a couple of weeks.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to give away Carbon Coin. Carbon Coin is, this were proposed in this great book called Ministry of the Future, where if you can sequester a ton of carbon, you get a carbon coin, which is valuable. We're going to give away carbon coins. We're going to have the players earn carbon coins, which will have a real value to them. Mm-hmm. And I even proposed giving away some land, and then everybody goes, what? You're going to give away land? And I think I can get some land to give away that could be stewarded by winners of this game. If it's going to be a competition, people will learn this thing. We want people to learn it fast. We want them to learn it as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. We want millions of people to learn this game fast, because it will teach you so much about sustainability now. It will teach you how the world is working, and it brings those two parallel paths that we're traversing. One, we're living our lives. We want everything to be normal. We want everything to be comfortable and secure. And then over here, parallel to that, is climate change. And it, we're barreling down this track where climate change, it's hotter today in Canada than it's ever been. And everybody says, oh, it's hotter over there. It was blistering hot in my backyard today. I'm going, do I want it like this? So I, what I'm saying is we need to bring these paths a little closer together so people are going, well, maybe I can do a little bit more. Don't do too much more. I mean, don't actually get involved, but just do a little bit. How about one meal a week less of red meat? You know, it's not asking for a whole lot. How about one less trip to the store or one less trip across town that you don't really need to take in your car? Mm-hmm. Because you find out that the average automobile in the United States puts up, guess what, 4.3 tons, metric tons of carbon every year. Maybe just drive a little bit less. Maybe get an electric car sooner than you thought. How about it? I don't know. I'm having fun. That's the thing. I think you can have fun and know the facts. You don't have to get depressed and know the facts. Know the facts and try to solve some of the problems. I think they're solvable. And it's one of the funnest things I like to do is solve problems. I really enjoy it. And I think that's what I'm trying to do.
You are listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and I'm in the studio today with Eric Tierman, who we've decided is a media producer. He's just been telling us about a game that he is helping to develop
It's called Earth Island.
Earth Island.
Yeah, Connected Universe is the name of the company.
That was the name of a film back in the 50s. This Island Earth, it was called. Oh, yeah. what's the radio show going to be about?
The what? The radio show. By the way, I wanted to correct one mistake here. A lot of people think that I got an Academy Award for Women for America. I didn't. It's not. You won't read that anywhere.
But I read it in several places. But okay.
Well, maybe you will read it. I didn't print it there. What happened with Women for America is when we finished In the Nuclear Shadow, I said, let's make a movie about the powerful women in the country who are politicians, who are movers, shakers, you know, the Shirley Chisholms, the Ellen Goodmans, the Elizabeth Holzman, Pat Schroeder's of the world.
Yeah.
And so we got a little bit of funding. I went out as co-producer, director, and camera audio on that film. And when it was finished, I took a walk. I decided I didn't want to be a part of it, even though it was turned out to be a great movie. I had other things that I wanted to do. Mm. And so I do not have an Academy Award, even though I was co-producer at the beginning. I ended up taking a walk, and I have a film credit on the end at this point.
So the film got the award, but you don't have it. Okay. Well, I mean,
that's correct.
You know, but yeah, I still,
somebody else got the award. It's fine.
Still, that's something, you know.
I was happy to be involved with it for sure.
Yeah. So, okay, Kids on Climate. What's that going to be?
Well, Kids on Climate is a radio show that I am working on, although it's taken a backseat to Earth Island at this point, but I think we're almost there. And you'll be able to go to a website where you can, and we thought about doing this with kids, but then Rachel Goodman, who works here at K-Squid, said, you're going to have to get, in order for kids to be on a radio program, you have to get
permission.
You have to get permission from their parents, everybody.
Right, right.
So you can't really go through the web to do that.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, we'll have the kids ask the questions. So these kids are going to be asking questions of adults. What is going on, folks out there? Oh, I heard the ice sheet is melting off of Greenland, and we're going to get 8 inches of ocean rise. Can you tell us what's happening, folks, adults? And so any adult can answer these questions. There'll be like 6 or 10 questions on this website. They'll just press a button on the website and answer the question or speak as long as they want to. And then in my little editing room, I would cut together the best, most fantastic, humorous, unbelievable responses that adults are coming up with as solutions for these children. I mean, we have to tell them something, right?
We do. It sounds like this would be good for adults, too.
It'll be good
place
for adults
to ask questions.
Too.
Masquerade as a child, right, which is usually not legal, but...
We're all grown-up children, whether we want to admit it or not. Most of us haven't really gotten to...
Yeah. So when is this going to go live?
As soon as we get it finished, you will be the first to know. Because Rachel Goodman said that if I get a little two-minute show, we could play it.
Yeah.
And I was hoping to do something on a daily basis, which is a lot of work, of course, as you well know. So we'll get the Earth Island up and running probably first, and then I'll attack the other one.
Yeah. You know, I thought that we're getting close to the end of the show, and I thought we could engage in some film criticism and analysis, because I saw somewhere that you had taught that kind of stuff, right, when you were teaching. And do you think there are any commercial films that have seriously addressed climate change? Can you?
Well, Don't Look Up, obviously, is the most recent one. Leonardo DiCaprio and Meryl Streep and, you know, all the wonderful actors that they have in that movie. I think Michael Moore just exec produced a movie called Planet of the Humans, which I made it through to the end of it. I don't know. Have you seen that one, Ronnie?
No, I haven't. But
okay.
Is the Statue of Liberty offshore at the end of it?
It's a bit like that. It's a bit depressing.
Yeah.
If everything in that movie is true, which I can't say I know whether it's true or not, but I hope it's not, it's a pretty depressing picture. And I think we need to be... I think we need the ice water challenge, you know, wake up, folks. But I don't think a lot of what was in that film is accurate. Mm. But it's certainly, I wouldn't recommend it, but it's certainly maybe worth watching. What other films are out there that are doing climate change? I don't know. I haven't seen anything else. Mad Max, you mentioned. I'm not sure that's going to help us. The Walking Dead series. The zombies. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think people think maybe it's going to get like that, but I think they hope that it's not.
I think zombies are metaphors for capitalism, for consumers. You know, I've seen different explanations of that. Right, but of course nobody thinks about that. They just think they're dead people walking around. That's part of the issue with commercial films, right? They have to entertain, and so any kind of didactic lesson often gets lost in the noise. Have you read Kim Stanley Robinson's Ministry for the Future?
I got through part of it. It's brilliantly written, and it got me. It was a little overwhelming for me, although. The carbon coin sequence was sent to me by another friend of mine, Francesca Hampton, who got through the whole book and sent me some interesting ideas about carbon coin, which I'm going to include in the Earth Island game.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah.
We pick up little pieces here and there from different people, the network out there. You know, I don't think this climate change thing is unsolvable. I think people just have to kind of go inward a little bit and decide they don't need to consume so much. This land is such a land of plenty. You know, next door to my building, they just built a extra storage space.
Yeah.
I mean, it was rented before it was even finished. And 40 years ago, people were storing things in beacons. I remember these big beacons buildings, but there was nothing. We have so much in this country that we don't need to buy anymore, or buy it used, buy it less. I can only say it's a land of plenty. I'm a flea market junkie, so I go to the flea market and I repurpose things. I haven't bought a new shirt, pair of pants, or shoes in 15 years. I never go into new stores anymore. Because why?
You're bucking the fashion tide there, I guess. Huh?
Fashion?
Yeah.
Yeah, fashion. Yeah.
Well,
I look at fashion, I go, okay, terrific. I think it's terrific. I think everything everybody's doing is terrific.
As I wrote to you, when you're on radio, nobody can see whether you have pants on, right? And nobody cares what you're wearing, and I think that's an advantage.
I have pants on today.
Yeah, well, I do too. But
I have one thing I want to play, though, that I think...
Okay, one last thing, because then we have
it.
To wrap
and
things
then,
up. Okay.
And this is a film that I hope that you will remember. It was made a while back, and here it goes, and I think it's very powerful.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window. Open it and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. Then we'll figure out what to do about the depression and the inflation and the oil crisis. But first, get up out of your chairs, open the window, stick your head out and yell and say, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. But first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm as mad.
Well, we're going to cut that off there. That, of course, was the scene from Network. If you haven't seen it.
I think that's a powerful movie.
Yeah. Well, Eric, thank you for being my guest on Sustainability Now. It was great fun. You can watch some of the films online. I've put hyperlinks to them on the blurb for this show on the radio station website. And you can also see the work of Impact Creative on its website. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make K-Squid your community radio station and keep it going. And so, until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.